Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at theopenhouse.net.au blog site.
Well, I wonder if you've ever caught yourself in the act of self-deception. Probably not. I mean, by definition, self-deception means you're just not aware of it. But you may be surprised to hear, however, that we all deceive ourselves quite frequently to avoid pain, to justify our actions, to keep the peace. All of us are guilty of it, Christians included. According to Greg Ten Elsoff, self-deception can have some, obviously, negative ramifications, but it also can actually be a good thing. We'll find out what his answer is to that soon. Greg is an associate professor of philosophy and the author of a new book called I Told Me So, Self-Deception and the Christian Life. Greg, welcome to Open House.
Thank you.
You know, I'm going to be really examining everything I say for the next few moments too, after flicking through this book. You know, you highlight the fact that we so easily deceive ourselves. What is self-deception? Give us a working definition that we can keep in our mind as we do our conversation.
Yeah, so what I have in mind is this capacity that we have to manage our beliefs, but without regard for the truth. So very oftentimes we're trying to believe things in accordance with the truth or with our evidence, but sometimes we use belief for other ends, and self-deception happens when you're endeavoring to believe things, but not because you're pursuing the truth. So we all know about the father whose son is on drugs, and everybody knows it except him. The evidence is right there and obvious, but mm-hmm. he seems not capable of recognizing it. Or the spouse whose husband is cheating on her, and it's obvious to everyone except her that this is going on. The director of a nonprofit who somehow convinces himself that that it's okay to use the money that's been donated for an extravagant personal vacation. Those kinds of things.
Yeah, we're trying to convince ourselves that we can believe or indeed do the wrong thing because we just don't want to face the reality.
Right. That's right.
Okay, now why do we do it? Why do good, honest, rational people engage in self-deception? I mean, obviously to some degree it's to avoid pain, just that illustration you gave there about the father and the son on drugs.
Yeah, I think that's the primary motive, typically. There are things that are sort of evident to us, and to face them squarely is something we either can't or won't do at present, and so we've got to find strategies of avoidance, and self-deception is one of them.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it, that in recent history, various forms of philosophy, existentialism in particular, now we're getting a bit philosophical, which will be great for you and me, and probably leave half of our audience behind, but anyway... let's hope not. There was this kind of focus on not being so much a good person, but being an authentic person. Where did that take us, do you think?
Folks have always thought authenticity is a good thing. It's bad to be a hypocrite. It's bad to be false. With the existentialists came this idea that somehow authenticity is chief among the virtues, or that really being a good person just is being an authentic person. I was on a committee recently to select a high-level administrator in my university and came across this fascinating study where college-age folks, if you ask them which quality is most important in a leader, whereas older generations would have said competency, is the most important thing in a leader. Younger folks today think authenticity is the most important feature of leadership. So I think partly because of this movement in existentialism and partly because folks are just sort of fed up with phony leadership that they see in the media, they tend to be just elevating authenticity. They want what comes on the outside to be a perfect reflection of what's going on the inside. And part of the project of the book is to say that this has been a mistake, that while authenticity is a good thing, it's been a mistake to elevate it as highly as we have.
Yeah, so how can you be authentic but still be self-deceived?
Uh-huh. Well, in the Christian context, if you've got somebody who has taken upon themselves to follow after Jesus, arguably at the very heart of the Christian project is the task of following Jesus, or in other words, imitating him, trying to take on his way of life. Well, anytime you try to imitate someone other than yourself, what you do on the outside won't be a perfect reflection of what's going on the inside. You'll be, in some ways, acting in ways that are false to yourself but true to the person you're trying to imitate in the very project of imitation. Mm-hmm. And so there's a sense in which Christians are called to a life of not perfectly expressing on the outside what's going on the inside.
Yeah, okay, I get it. This is Open House across the nation. Greg Ten Elsoff is with us, author of I Told Me So. We're talking about self-deception. If you've got a comment to throw in, 1-300-40-2020, we're looking at how it's just so easy to do and how we actually do it all the time, primarily to basically avoid pain. Now, Greg, you talk about five main strategies we use to deceive ourselves. I think these are fascinating. I'll give you the strategy and you can kind of flesh it out. Number one is attention management.
Yeah, in many ways, I think this is the most common one. So what we do is, it turns out we've got quite a bit of control over where we direct our attention. And very often we protect our cherished beliefs simply by attending to evidence that will support them.
Mm-hmm.
I had a friend who was born and raised in a Christian context, and at some point in early adulthood, he thought to himself, I want to take an objective look at the evidence for my faith and see whether I've taken on a religion that's really reasonable. And so he told me he was doing this. I, as a philosopher, thought this is a fantastic thing that he's doing. I was all for it. And I asked him, what are you reading in your exploration of the evidence? And he went on to rattle off, 8, 9, 10 books. Not bad for a, working professional with a young family.
Mm.
But it turned out that all of these books were written by Christians
mm-hmm.
who were, presenting the evidence for and against Christian belief. And when I asked him, well, do you suppose there are any non-Christians writing on this topic? He seemed a little puzzled by the question, and he said, well, I suppose there probably are, but I just haven't made it much of a project to find out who they are, And it seemed utterly lost on him that this was a kind of one-sided inquiry, arguably aimed at protecting his cherished beliefs rather than taking a step back.
Yeah, wow, we can all do that too, can't we? Whether we're Christians or atheists or agnostics
that's right.
or whatever, that's important. Number one is attention management. Number two is procrastination.
Yeah, procrastination's a nice one. The philosopher Kierkegaard said there's this tiny little moment between understanding and doing. In the Christian context, often what happens is we understand what it is that we're supposed to do, really in Christian or non-Christian context. Suppose you're confronted with some profound need. Sometimes in church we're presented with a mission organization and we're given an opportunity to give to this mission organization.
Mm-hmm.
And having seen the presentation, we might think, it's just obvious that I should do this. I'm relatively wealthy. I should give $100 or so to this cause. But then we procrastinate. We think, well, I don't have my checkbook here with me, and even if I did, I should check online, see what my balance is. I'll give to this cause, but I'll do it next week. I'll do it after I've had a chance to look at my finances and come back to it.
Hmm.
Then a week later, it's not as compelling. We don't find as strong a tug to give to this organization that we've decided to give to. And if we wait long enough, we may find ourselves no longer with any sense of obligation to give at all.
Sure.
So sometimes we take on these beliefs that are really demanding. I ought to do this or I ought to do that. But if we just procrastinate on acting, oftentimes the belief will go away.
Yeah, okay. That's the second strategy of self-deception. The third one you say is perspective switching.
Yeah, perspective switching is a nice one. It's especially good for folks in leadership, corporate leadership or Christian leadership.
Right.
If you can surround yourself with people who think you're just the best thing going, and you allow them to talk to you about that, oftentimes you can find yourself taking on their perspective on you, and you might find that a much more, satisfying perspective on you than your own perspective on you, complete with awareness of all your faults and missteps and the like.
Okay. So, funny enough, the actual phrase would almost suggest that you're wanting to be objective. You're changing perspectives and wanting to see things from other people's perspective, but in this case, you're actually saying, no, we can actually do that. So we arrive at a belief that we want to believe.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Okay. Five strategies of how we self-deceive: attention management, procrastination, perspective switching, number four, rationalizing.
Yeah, rationalizing, this one is perhaps the most familiar of the strategies I discuss. So very often there's something that we do. Perhaps we do something that's morally gray. We decide not to include something in our income tax report or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then we tell ourselves a story about why this is okay. We come up with reasons which, if they were actually operative, would justify what it is that we've done. But in fact, the reason we did what we did is because we're just selfish and unwilling to give our money away.
Mm.
So you tell stories that would make what you've done reasonable were the stories true, but as it turns out, the stories aren't true.
Yeah, well, you mentioned before about the leader of a non-profit who embezzles some money, and there's normally some sort of great rationalization. I'm going to pay it back.
That's right.
I'm not paid what I'm worth anyway. You know, I've never charged for overtime. It's very easy to rationalize.
Or just think of the opportunity to spread the gospel on this trip I'm going to take.
Right, okay. That's a good one for the Christians, yeah. Okay, right. Then the fifth strategy you call resentment. I've never heard that word before.
Resentment, yes.
Resentment.
This is a fascinating one. This is where we either reorganize or we rename our emotions in order to make, I don't know, life more livable for ourselves. Suppose I'm angry with someone in my social context, a brother or a friend or something. But suppose I also think that anger is a kind of vice. We shouldn't be angry with the folks around us. Well, I might rename my anger. I might say all kinds of bad things about this person I'm angry with in my groups. But then when asked, well, why are you saying all these things? I might say, well, it's because I'm concerned or I'm sad for this person. I feel like we all need to know what I'm saying about him so that we can gather around and help him. In Christian context, it might be in a prayer group.
I'm saying all of these
bad things about him so that we can pray for him. Or if I'm jealous of my friend's flat screen TV, you know, I might say things like, well, I'm just concerned for him. You know, they watch way too much TV anyway, and with this new flat screen, they're just going to have the TV on all the time. And I might convince myself that really what's happening is concern for my friend instead of just outright jealousy,
yeah,
which is what
okay.
it is.
And that's resentment.
Yeah.
This is Open House right across the nation. Philosopher Greg Tenelsov is with us. He's written this book called I Told Me So. We're talking about self-deception and how easy it is. We all do it in some way. theopenhouse.net.au is the place for the podcast too. Now, the fact is, Greg, most of us are nodding in agreement saying, oh yeah, I remember when so-and-so did the resentment and when I remember the rationalization and this and this and this and this and this. It's very easy to think about other people who are deceiving themselves.
Right.
We tend to be blind to the fact that we do it ourselves or we open ourselves up and we go, dear me, I've got something to look at. I'm doing a lot of these things.
Yeah, or maybe I am. You might wonder whether you are, and you might wonder whether you'd even know it if you were. I mean, so the book is intended to sort of get you wondering, but then it's also intended to give you some strategies mm-hmm. for finding out whether you really are, and if you are, strategies for moving out of the kind of self-deception that's harmful.
Okay, well, I want to get to that soon. I want to also, before we go there, though, talk about this idea that maybe self-deception can serve a legitimate purpose and isn't all bad. And you've really got me interested there.
From a Christian perspective, so here's what got me thinking about this. From a Christian perspective, we're designed by God with our cognitive faculties, and God could have, if he wanted to, create us in such a way that we always follow the evidence. We always believe what is most evident to us.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't. He gave us this amazing capacity to turn our attention away from the evidence, to believe things that aren't in keeping with the evidence. And I started to wonder, well, why? Why would God do this? Why would he create us in this capacity? Is there some legitimate end that this serves? And I guess I think there is. So if you start with other person deception, most of us are quite comfortable with the idea that sometimes, not very often, but sometimes it's okay to lie to someone else. It might even be an act of love to lie to someone else or to keep some particular truth from them.
You're going to have to follow that up with an example, I tell you.
Yeah, so suppose... suppose I find out that your son is on drugs,
mm-hmm.
and I've called you up to tell you this hard truth. I don't want to tell you, but I love you, and we're gonna work through it together. And as soon as you get on the phone, you start telling me that you've just lost your job, that your wife is losing you, and you're going through this horrific time. And in fact, you're thinking of doing something drastic. Well, clearly, this is just the wrong time to tell you about your son and his. And
mm-hmm.
his drug addiction.
Mm-hmm.
If we come anywhere near that topic, I'm going to avoid it. I'm going to try to direct your attention elsewhere. I'm going to do anything I can to keep this painful truth from you for now,
mm-hmm.
because I wouldn't be serving you in any way to bring it up. Or in more extreme examples, suppose there's a terrorist on the loose and you're hiding the person this terrorist is looking for in your basement, and he comes to your door and asks you, are you hiding the person I'm looking for in your basement? You, of course, most of us are comfortable with the idea that what you ought to do is lie there.
Right.
You ought to lie to the terrorist and tell him that, you know, the person he's looking for is nowhere to be found.
Yeah, we've even got some biblical examples of that, haven't we, with Rahab?
That's right. So now the idea is, if we think we should be gracious in that way to other people, why not think that there are circumstances in which we should be similarly gracious to ourselves. Maybe there are some truths that we're just not positioned to handle right at present, and we ought to give ourselves the grace to be hiding from them.
Yeah, and like what? Again, an example.
Well, you take cancer wards. Terminal cancer wards are full of people who are arguably self-deceived. Many of them think, despite the odds, despite the overwhelming evidence to the contrary, that they're going to beat it. They're going to beat the cancer. They're going to receive a miraculous answer to prayer. They're going to beat the odds somehow. And most of us aren't charging into the cancer wards correcting these people's, you know, self-deceptive beliefs. And that's because I guess there are good studies that show that believing that you're going to get better actually increases your chances of getting better. And we think in these circumstances, you know, increasing your odds of getting better is more important than believing the truth in this circumstance.
Where is the difference, though, between self-deception and simply hope, that you're holding out hope that, yes, God will come through with a miraculous answer to prayer, or, you know, within the next few months, the scientists will stumble on the cure?
Yeah, hope doesn't inform action in the way that belief does. So to hope that something will come about is to think about the joy that you'd have if it did come about. But if you hope that something will happen, you're not going to organize your action and your life around it. So I hope I win the lottery, but I'm not planning my finances, right, in the light of that prospect. Were I to believe that I was going to win the lottery, well, then I'd be, you know, planning my finances a little bit differently. I'd be organizing my life around that idea.
1-300-40-2020. I'd love to hear your thoughts on what Greg's sharing. It's fascinating, isn't it? Okay, Greg, well, before we get to some strategies on how to kind of avoid the harmful self-deception aspects, because, I mean, to some degree, it might be said that, well, we've just given people some reasons. So let me look back over these five strategies to rationalize why we can actually self-deceive.
Yeah.
Why shouldn't we self-deceive? What are the negative aspects of it?
Well, very often self-deception promotes or facilitates our other sinful activities. So that to the extent that I'm not willing to notice the various ways in which I act unlovingly towards other people, or in a kind of hot topics case, to the extent that I'm unwilling to recognize racial bias in my own thinking toward other people, I'm likely to keep going with my racial mistreatment of others. And so self-deception goes awry, it gets misappropriated when it gets put in the service of continued destructive activity.
Yes. So, I mean, it actually it interrupts the great ethic of Christian love, doesn't it?
That's right. Yeah. So that I think in general, you know, our cognitive faculties are given to us for the purpose of believing what's true, believing what's rational, and the rest. And it's only in these very rare and specialized circumstances that self-deception serves legitimate ends. Most often, self-deception is misappropriated, and it's put in the service of destructive activity.
Well, even the fact that we want to jump onto that little loophole that we almost thought you were giving us there says something, doesn't
right.
it?
That's right.
It certainly does. Okay, Greg, give us some ideas then as to how we can find out where we are self-deceiving ourselves and actually move away from it so that we can actually be truly good, loving people, at least simply on the pathway to being so.
Yeah. Well, at the risk of sounding self-serving, the first step is to seriously consider the possibility that we are deceived, to acknowledge the possibility that we are, and to learn something about the strategies common in self-deception. If you're thinking about this topic, if you're reading books on self-deception, you're already light years ahead of the crowd, I think. The second thing, I think, is we ought to pay careful attention to our groups, the groups that we move in. One of the forms that self-deception can take that we haven't talked about yet is groupthink. It turns out that there are heights of self-deception, extreme variants of it, that are possible in groups that perhaps we can't even manage by ourselves. So by attending to the cherished beliefs of our group, we can often locate those places in our cognitive lives where we're likely to be self-deceived.
Wow, so if we always hang around atheists, or if we always hang around Christians, or if we always hang around racists, or if we always hang around, like you said, the business environment where you've got a whole heap of people around you who just keep on reinforcing how wonderful you are, we will certainly be aided in our self-deception.
That's right. In many of our groups, we run from disagreement as though it's some kind of a plague. We've really come to I don't know whether it's to be afraid of disagreement or just to be put off by it, but the occasion to have a safe and thoughtful discussion with someone who really loves you and disagrees with you passionately is a rare and precious gift.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of our most effective resources for unearthing our own unquestioned assumptions.
Yes.
And so we ought to be seeking membership in groups where there's the possibility of safe and passionate disagreement, where our commitments to one another stand on something other than agreement about these various kinds of things,
yes.
And so that we can disagree.
Mm-hmm. What else can we do?
There's a section in my book where I talk about dying. So it turns out...
You philosophers are such rosy-cheeked people, aren't you?
That's right. So it turns out one of the really effective strategies for moving away from destructive self-deception is dying to sinful habits or destructive patterns mm-hmm. of behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So oftentimes people have secrets that they're keeping. Christian or non-Christian, folks are running around with secrets about themselves, habits and patterns in themselves that they know to be destructive or sinful, but which they haven't found a place to safely reveal. And it turns out if you've got a secret like that, if you're living a sort of hypocritical life, you're all set up for self-deception because nobody likes the thought of themselves as a hypocrite.
Mm.
And so if you've forced yourself into hypocrisy by keeping a kind of destructive or sinful habit a secret, you're very likely to be falling prey to self-deception. So mm. one of the classic spiritual disciplines in the Christian way is confession. And so what I suggest in the book is that you find a few people who you're pretty sure will love you no matter what,
mm.
and just let it all out. Tell them the good and the bad and the ugly. And there's a kind of power in confession. It takes all the power out of a secret and helps us move away from hypocrisy and self-deception.
Yeah, and going back to our original conversation on groups and not being kind of limited to one group, I was thinking about the passages in Scripture which call Christians to, you know, not let go of being part of a church body, a group of people who are followers of the way, who actually are believing in the same things as you and helping you to move along those lines. And this is where obviously you need a group like this to be able to confess to. You don't want to be in part of a group who says, oh, there's nothing wrong with what you're doing.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
But what you were saying is don't limit yourself there, expose yourself and be challenged by other groups as well.
That's right. So yeah. if you're gonna confess addiction to wealth, you might want to choose someone other than your rich neighbor.
You just might.
Who might just talk you out of the fact that you've got anything wrong.
Yes, that's right. You might be engaging in perspective switching then.
That's right.
Go back to
exactly.
One of our stretches.
Exactly
well, it's
right.
A bit of a fascinating conversation, Greg. Thanks for your time. Really appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah, Associate Professor Greg Tenelsoff there, a philosopher and author of I Told Me So, Self-Deception and the Christian Life. It's through Erdman's books.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast, thanks to Christian Super and Real World Technology. To hear more from Open House, visit theopenhouse.net.au.